Chapter 2. Voice of female distress was lamentably distinguished, announced the dreadful catastrophe. In a few moments all was hushed, except the roaring of the winds, and the dashing of the waves. The wreck was buried in the deep, and not an atom of it was ever afterwards seen. Apostrophe, the most beautiful and affecting incident I know, associated with a shipwreck, succeeds this dismal story for a winter night. The Grosvenor, East Indiaman, homeward bound, goes ashore on the coast of Caffraria. It is resolved that the officers, passengers, and crew, in number 135 souls, shall endeavor to penetrate on foot, across trackless deserts, infested by wild beasts and cruel savages, to the Dutch settlements at the Cape of Good Hope. With this forlorn object before them, they finally separate into two parties never more to meet on earth. There is a solitary child among the passengers, a little boy of 7 years old who has no relation there. And when the first party is moving away, he cries after some member of it who has been kind to him. The crying of a child might be supposed to be a little thing to men in such great extremity, but it touches them, and he is immediately taken into that detachment. From which time forth, this child is sublimely made a sacred charge. He is pushed, on a little raft, across broad rivers by the swimming sailors. They carry him by turns through the deep sand and long grass, he patiently walking at all other times. They share with him such putrid fish as they find to eat. They lie down and wait for him when the rough carpenter, who becomes his especial friend, lags behind. Beset by lions and tigers, by savages, by thirst, by hunger, by death in a crowd of ghastly shapes, they never, O Father of all mankind, thy name be blessed for it. Forget this child. The captain stops exhausted, and his faithful coxswain goes back, and is seen to sit down by his side, and neither of the two shall be any more beheld until the great last day. But, as the rest go on for their lives, they take the child with them. The carpenter dies of poisonous berries eaten in starvation, and the steward, succeeding to the command of the party, succeeds to the sacred guardianship of the child. God knows all he does for the poor baby, how he cheerfully carries him in his arms, when he himself is weak and ill, how he feeds him, when he himself is gripe with want, how he folds his ragged jacket round him, lays his little worn face with a woman's tenderness upon his sunburnt breast, soothes him in his sufferings, sings to him as he limps along, unmindful of his own parched and bleeding feet. Divided for a few days from the rest, they dig a grave in the sand, and bury their good friend the cooper, these two companions alone in the wilderness, and then the time comes, when they both are ill, and beg their wretched partners in despair, reduced and few in number now, to wait by them one day. They wait by them one day, they wait by them 2 days. On the morning of the third, they move very softly about, in making their preparations for the resumption of their journey, for the child is sleeping by the fire, and it is agreed with one consent that he shall not be disturbed until the last moment. The moment comes, the fire is dying, and the child is dead. His faithful friend, the steward, lingers but a little while behind him. His grief is great, he staggers on for a few days, lies down in the desert, and dies. But he shall be reunited in his immortal spirit, who can doubt it, with the child, when he and the poor carpenter shall be raised up with the words, "Inasmuch as ye have done it unto the least of these, ye have done it unto me." Apostrophe, as I recall the dispersal and disappearance of nearly all the participators in this once famous shipwreck, a mere handful being recovered at last, and the legends that were long afterwards revived from time to time among the English officers at the Cape, of a white woman with an infant, said to have been seen weeping outside a savage hut far in the interior, who was whisperingly associated with the remembrance of the missing lady saved from the wrecked vessel, and who was often sought but never found, thoughts of another kind of travel came into my mind. Thoughts of a voyager unexpectedly summoned from home, who traveled a vast distance, and could never return. Thoughts of this unhappy wayfarer in the depths of his sorrow, in the bitterness of his anguish, in the helplessness of his self-reproach, in the desperation of his desire to set right what he had left wrong and do what he had left undone. For there were many, many things he had neglected. Little matters while he was at home and surrounded by them, but things of mighty moment when he was at an immeasurable distance. There were many, many blessings that he had inadequately felt. There were many trivial injuries that he had not forgiven. There was love that he had but poorly returned. There was friendship that he had too lightly prized. There were a million kind words that he might have spoken, a million kind looks that he might have given, uncountable slight easy deeds in which he might have been most truly great and good. Oh, for a day, he would exclaim, for but one day to make amends. But the sun never shone upon that happy day, and out of his remote captivity he never came. Why does this traveler's fate obscure, on New Year's Eve, the other histories of travelers with which my mind was filled but now, and cast a solemn shadow over me? Must I one day make his journey? Even so, who shall say that I may not then be tortured by such late regrets, that I may not then look from my exile on my empty place and undone work? I stand upon a seashore where the waves are ears. They break and fall, and I may little heed them, but with every wave the sea is rising, and I know that it will float me on this traveler's voyage at last. The begging letter writer, the amount of money he annually diverts from wholesome and useful purposes in the United Kingdom, would be a set-off against the window tax. He is one of the most shameless frauds and impositions of this time. In his idleness, his mendacity, and the immeasurable harm he does to the deserving, dirtying the stream of true benevolence, and muddling the brains of foolish justices, with inability to distinguish between the base coin of distress and the true currency we have always among us, he is more worthy of Norfolk Island than three-fourths of the worst characters who are sent there. Under any rational system, he would have been sent there long ago. I, the writer of this paper, have been, for some time, a chosen receiver of begging letters. For 14 years, my house has been made as regular a receiving house for such communications as any one of the great branch post offices is for general correspondence. I ought to know something of the begging letter writer. He has besieged my door at all hours of the day and night. He has fought my servant. He has lain in ambush for me, going out and coming in. He has followed me out of town into the country. He has appeared at provincial hotels, where I have been staying for only a few hours. He has written to me from immense distances, when I have been out of England. He has fallen sick. He has died and been buried. He has come to life again, and again departed from this transitory scene. He has been his own son, his own mother, his own baby, his idiot brother, his uncle, his aunt, his aged grandfather. He has wanted a great coat to go to India in, a pound to set him up in life forever, a pair of boots to take him to the coast of China, a hat to get him into a permanent situation under government. He has frequently been exactly 7 and 6 pence short of independence. He has had such openings at Liverpool posts of great trust and confidence in merchants' houses, which nothing but 7 and 6 pence was wanting to him to secure, that I wonder he is not mayor of that flourishing town at the present moment. The natural phenomena of which he has been the victim are of a most astounding nature. He has had 2 children who have never grown up, who have never had anything to cover them at night, who have been continually driving him mad by asking in vain for food, who have never come out of fevers and measles, which, I suppose, has accounted for his fuming his letters with tobacco smoke as a disinfectant, who have never changed in the least degree through 14 long revolving years. As to his wife, what that suffering woman has undergone, nobody knows. She has always been in an interesting situation through the same long period, and has never been confined yet. His devotion to her has been unceasing. He has never cared for himself. he could have perished, he would rather, in short, but was it not his Christian duty as a man, a husband, and a father, to write begging letters, when he looked at her?
He has usually remarked that he would call in the evening for an answer to this question.
He has been the sport of the strangest misfortunes. What his brother has done to him would have broken anybody else's heart. His brother went into business with him, and ran away with the money. His brother got him to be security for an immense sum, and left him to pay it. His brother would have given him employment to the tune of hundreds a year, if he would have consented to write letters on a Sunday. His brother enunciated principles incompatible with his religious views, and he could not, in consequence, permit his brother to provide for him. His landlord has never shown a spark of human feeling. When he put in that execution, I don't know, but he has never taken it out. The broker's man has grown gray in possession. They will have to bury him someday. He has been attached to every conceivable pursuit. He has been in the army, in the navy, in the church, in the law, connected with the press, the fine arts, public institutions, every description and grade of business. He has been brought up as a gentleman. He has been at every college in Oxford and Cambridge. He can quote Latin in his letters,
but generally misspells some minor English word.
He can tell you what Shakespeare says about begging better than you know it. It is to be observed that in the midst of his afflictions he always reads the newspapers, and rounds off his appeal with some allusion, that may be supposed to be in my way, to the popular subject of the hour. His life presents a series of inconsistencies. Sometimes he has never written such a letter before. He blushes with shame. That is the first time, that shall be the last. Don't answer it, and let it be understood that, then, he will kill himself quietly. Sometimes,
and more frequently,
he has written a few such letters. Then he encloses the answers, with an intimation that they are of inestimable value to him, and a request that they may be carefully returned. He is fond of enclosing something, verses, letters, pawnbrokers' duplicates, anything to necessitate an answer. He is very severe upon the pampered minion of fortune, apostrophe, who refused him the half-sovereign referred to in the enclosure number 2, but he knows me better. He writes in a variety of styles, sometimes in low spirits, sometimes quite jocosely. When he is in low spirits he writes downhill, and repeats words, these little indications being expressive of the perturbation of his mind. When he is more vivacious, he is frank with me, he is quite the agreeable rattle. I know what human nature is, who better? Well, he had a little money once, and he ran through it as many men have done before him. He finds his old friends turned away from him now, many men have done that before him too. Shall he tell me why he writes to me? Because he has no kind of claim upon me. He puts it on that ground plainly, and begs to ask for the loan,
as I know human nature,
of 2 sovereigns, to be repaid next Tuesday 6 weeks, before 12 at noon. Sometimes, when he is sure that I have found him out, and that there is no chance of money, he writes to inform me that I have got rid of him at last. He has enlisted into the company's service, and is off directly, but he wants a cheese. He is informed by the sergeant that it is essential to his prospects in the regiment that he should take out a single Gloucester cheese, weighing from 12 to 15 pounds. 8 or 9 shillings would buy it. He does not ask for money after what has passed, but if he calls at 9, tomorrow morning may he hope to find a cheese? And is there anything he can do to show his gratitude in Bengal? Once he wrote me rather a special letter, proposing relief in kind. He had got into a little trouble by leaving parcels of mud done up in brown paper at people's houses, on pretense of being a railway porter, in which character he received carriage money. This sportive fancy he expiated in the House of Correction. Not long after his release, and on a Sunday morning, he called with a letter,
having first dusted himself all over,
in which he gave me to understand that, being resolved to earn an honest livelihood, He had been traveling about the country with a cart of crockery. But he had been doing pretty well until the day before, when his horse had dropped down dead near Chatham, in Kent. But this had reduced him to the unpleasant necessity of getting into the shafts himself, and drawing the cart of crockery to London, a somewhat exhausting pull of 30 miles. That he did not venture to ask again for money, but that if I would have the goodness to leave him out a donkey, he would call for the animal before breakfast. At another time, my friend, I am describing actual experiences, introduced himself as a literary gentleman in the last extremity of distress. He had had a play accepted at a certain theater which was really open. Its representation was delayed by the indisposition of a leading actor who was really ill, and he and his were in a state of absolute starvation. If he made his necessities known to the manager of the theater, he put it to me to say what kind of treatment he might expect. Well, we got over that difficulty to our mutual satisfaction. A little while afterwards he was in some other strait. I think Mrs. Southcote, his wife, was in extremity and we adjusted that point too. A little while afterwards he had taken a new house, and was going headlong to ruin for want of a water butt. I had my misgivings about the water butt, and did not reply to that epistle. But a little while afterwards, I had reason to feel penitent for my neglect. He wrote me a few broken-hearted lines, informing me that the dear partner of his sorrows died in his arms last night at 9 o'clock. I dispatched a trusty messenger to comfort the bereaved mourner and his poor children. But the messenger went so soon, that the play was not ready to be played out. My friend was not at home, and his wife was in a most delightful state of health. He was taken up by the Mendicity Society informally, it afterwards appeared, and I presented myself at a London police office with my testimony against him. The magistrate was wonderfully struck by his educational acquirements, deeply impressed by the excellence of his letters, exceedingly sorry to see a man of his attainments there, complimented him highly on his powers of composition, and was quite charmed to have the agreeable duty of discharging him. A collection was made for the poor fellow, apostrophe as he was called in the reports, and I left the court with a comfortable sense of being universally regarded as a sort of monster. Next day comes to me a friend of mine, the governor of a large prison. Why did you ever go to the police office against that man, apostrophe says he, without coming to me first? I know all about him and his frauds. He lodged in the house of one of my warders, at the very time when he first wrote to you, and then he was eating spring lamb at 18 pence a pound, and early asparagus at I don't know how much a bundle. Apostrophe apostrophe on that very same day, and in that very same hour, my injured gentleman wrote a solemn address to me, demanding to know what compensation I proposed to make him for his having passed the night in a loathsome dungeon. Apostrophe and next morning an Irish gentleman, a member of the same fraternity, who had read the case, and was very well persuaded I should be chary of going to that police office again, positively refused to leave my door for less than a sovereign, and, resolved to besiege me into compliance, literally sat down before it for 10 mortal hours. The garrison being well provisioned, I remained within the walls, and he raised the siege at midnight with a prodigious alarum on the bell. The begging letter writer often has an extensive circle of acquaintance. Whole pages of the court guide are ready to be references for him. Noblemen and gentlemen write to say there never was such a man for probity and virtue. They have known him time out of mind, and there is nothing they wouldn't do for him. Somehow, they don't give him that £1.10 he stands in need of. But perhaps it is not enough, they want to do more, and his Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.